You're listening to a 4x4 Radio Network podcast.
This episode of the Sinister Podcast is brought to you by LT Wright Knives. LT Wright Knives are handcrafted in Ohio with the finest locally sourced materials. They build everything from everyday carry to bushcraft and even overland specific. Everything that LTWK builds comes with a lifetime guarantee and is designed from the ground up to be a solid working knife. Find out more online at centersteer.com/LTWK. The Center Steer Podcast, a Land Rover podcast by Land Rover owners. Welcome to the Center Steer Podcast. This is show number 36 for March 2016. This is the only Land Rover podcast that we are aware of, and we're part of the 4x4 Radio Network. I invite you to check out the 4x4 related shows at 4x4radionetwork.com. Don't forget to visit our website, centersteer.com, to listen to previous shows and for show notes, which have links to stories discussed in today's show. And I want to thank you for your comments, follows, likes on Facebook, Twitter, and email. I am your host, John Costage. We're here in wonderful North Huntingdon, Pennsylvania. It is Good Friday. It's we're recording at an unusual time.
It's a good Friday. Maybe not a great Friday, but it's a good Friday.
It's a good Friday. That's right.
Very good.
Overcast. I'm joined in the studio today by sitting across from me is...
I'm Harold.
And this is Dave Carroll.
Wonderful, Dave. Thanks for joining us, Dave. We wanted to have you last month for the winter romp update, but I know you had some obligations you couldn't get out of.
I was recovering from the winter romp.
You were thawing out.
Yes.
So that's a little teaser for you. Dave will talk to us later about the winter romp when we get into trail rides and such.
Now that winter is officially over.
Indeed it is. And unfortunately, Morgan, our panelist, correspondent, contributor from Vermont, is unable to join us due to work commitments, so we will soldier on without him.
Vermont is closed today.
Our guest this month is Mike Bishop. This will be the part two of our conversation with Mike Bishop, which, of course, we recorded last month. We'll now have part two this month for you just in a few minutes after we talk about the news. And first up, February sales numbers. Jag Land Rover continues to lead the pace here in North America, in the United States specifically. Their sales were up 30.5% in February. This is sales over from the previous February, so February 16 over February of 15. Specifically, Jaguar sold Land Rover sold 1,500 more cars, trucks than they did in 15, so 4,900 versus 6,400. Volvo and Maserati were the only makes that the brands that sold more than Land Rover in the month. Volvo was up 31% and Maserati was up 51%, but Maserati sold 481 cars versus 728.
I was going to say they sold three instead of two.
Yes, exactly. Good news for Jaguar. They were up. They sold almost exactly 100 more cars in February of 16 than they did February of 15. So overall, as a make, JLR North America was up 25%, beating Ford, Honda, Fiat, Nissan in 25% increase in sales month to month, year over year in the same month. So good news for JLR. Probably here in North America contributed to the low gas prices. If you're not North America, you probably wouldn't know necessarily that our gas prices have fallen sharply in the last year, probably almost $2 off a gallon.
Well, it inched back up in the past couple of weeks.
That's true. Yeah, I did notice my diesel went up about 10 cents.
Quite a bit, actually. The premium gasoline went up as well quite a bit.
But overall, it's still, compared to last year, it's been down almost $2-$4 a gallon.
Still a relative bargain.
It's absolutely, absolutely. And it's also attributed to Land Rover doing their continual refresh of the lineup and adding the Disco Sport and adding the Evoque. So all those things.
So Jerry McGovern's going to take credit for this.
Speaking of Jerry, this is, and of course, I highly recommend you go out to the show notes. I will have a link to this article, and then there's a video that you should watch. It's 5 minutes. It's an interview with JLR's top designers, Jerry McGovern and Callum. Oh, damn it. What's Mr. Callum's first name? I can't see it here immediately.
Ian,
thank you. Ian McCallum. So, of course, as we know, Jerry McGovern is the designer of Land Rover, and Ian McCallum is the designer for Jaguar. And so there'll be a link out to watch this video. It's called Great British Design. It's an interview that was done at the Royal Art College with Jerry and Ian. And they kind of piece this together on it. So I'll pause here while you go out and check the show notes, watch the video for a 5-minute video.
Yeah, we'll be back in 5 minutes.
That you want to watch. It's interesting.
It is.
I think that, you know, a couple interesting things that came out of it was this Britishness, and this is in the article about how you know, Britishness is something that is. It's an aesthetic. It should be restrained. It shouldn't be vulgar. It's reassuring, elegant, and tasteful. So says Ian McCallum. Ian McCallum. Ian Callum.
Ian Callum, yeah.
I was thinking of the guy that used to be on Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Different guy. On the other hand, Jerry McGovern talks about how you can't deliberately sit there and try to design Britishness. It comes intuitively. A tad ironic for Jerry to say that, who I think doesn't get Britishness.
That may be. I find it interesting that at the very end of the video, you know, he says that X-Type brings a smile to the face, and he says if we can get people to smile and be happy about a car, then that's good. I'm like,
this is from the guy who took the Defender from us.
Exactly, you know, and I don't know that his designs bring a smile to your face. I mean, they're not horrible by any stretch, but I guess my problem with Jerry's designs,
they kind of bring indifference to mine.
For me, his designs are all the same.
Yeah, they're generic. They don't really. I think he's losing sight of the identity of the product, and I think he's sort of homogenizing the designs to the point where they all kind of look alike, and
that's
they look
the
like everybody else's product.
That's the word I use, is homogenize. I certainly think the entire Land Rover lineup is very homogenized.
There's no distinctiveness anymore.
Yeah, what's the difference between a Range Rover Evoque, and you know the new Disco Sport? They just seem to be different sizes.
Whereas the Defender, which he hates, there's no mistaking that for anything else.
I like to use the word iconic. It is indeed is very distinctive and iconic.
Well, as much as I prefer, you know, the distinctive and iconic look. I mean, we do have to sell a number of cars here to keep the lights on.
Indeed.
So,
but you know, a redesigned Discovery, you know, with the proper bump up as it should,
right?
You can still do that in the modern world. Why do you have to rake the rear end down like you do with a Range Rover? Why can't we continue to have a Discovery that has the, I don't know what that's called, that Alpine bump up, because usually put those Alpine windows there.
Split level roof.
Oh, very exciting. You know, why can't we have that? Why does it have to angle down in the back all the time?
I concur. I mean, I'm just throwing that out there. I absolutely.
There's more than one way to sell product, and it doesn't all have to look like what he wants in order to sell it.
Or even, maybe a better way to phrase it is they don't have to all look the same. Every single one, they all look the same. They do. You know,
yeah.
The Range Rover
yeah.
looks the same. The Range Rover Sport looks the same. The Evoque looks the same, just as it looks like the Disco and the Disco Sport. And that's what bothers me about the upcoming Defender is. I think we know what it already looks like. Everyone's like, "Oh, what does a new Defender going to look like?" I think you already know.
Yeah,
it's going to have a bulbous front end and with a rear end that rakes back slightly lower because he likes that raking back.
And you just go out there and get yourself a Disco and a Range Rover, park them next to each other, and squint. Then you'll know what the new Defender is going to look like.
Yeah. So I. Check out the article. Check out this article. It's interesting in the sense of how they think, how these gentlemen think, and what they're looking for. And of course, they're the primary designers, not the only designers. But they certainly have to consider all a number of other factors, including sales figures, as Dave mentioned, and you know legal issues and other concerns that come up that they have to consider. And then, as I thought it was very interesting, too, that it, you know, Ian had said you have to defend your design, which is, of course, very much true. You have to defend your design once you have it and with all the things that occur.
What I thought was interesting when Jerry was saying that, in fact, I'll quote here from the article. He says that It's talking about the demise of the Defender after 68 years. Personally, I'm really excited about it. You know, the world has waited 60 years for a new Defender. It's about time we give them one. And when it comes, I think it will be a pivotal event in Land Rover's history. All I can say about that is the bombing of Pearl Harbor was a pivotal event in American history.
Okay. Whoa, okay. I don't know.
Doesn't mean it's a good thing.
No. But I think that's obvious. I mean, the fact that they're changing the Defender is clearly an obvious it's going to be pivotal. I mean, that's just period. You know, we don't know if it's going to be Pearl Harbor yet or if it's going to be the development of the Internet.
Pivotal isn't necessarily good is my point.
Exactly. My thought is, duh.
Yeah, not groundbreaking.
Duh. Yeah, we know it's going to be pivotal. We're well aware of that. We're past the duh stage, actually, because he's already said we're changing it. And it's already, of course, production has ended. So check out that article on design and let us know what you think. Actually, if you have any comments on that one, let us know what you think. So send an email, send a tweet. Maybe I'll read it on the next show. Continuing in the Jag Land Rover vein, there will be no Jaguar XK successor, and Land Rover won't chase Bentley. So I don't follow Jag as probably well as I should do. We know that there's an F-Pace coming, which is their SUV version. They currently have the F-Type SVR, which is sitting at the top of the Jag lineup. The automaker has abandoned plans to build a flagship coupe. The car that once occupied that slot, the XK, had ended production in the 2015 model year. Chief designer Ian Callum last May said the Jaguar was mulling over a couple options, a larger, more expensive car derived from the F-Type or a four-seater XJ-based coupe.
I got to say, I think they cover the needs pretty well with the F-Type and the XJ. I don't see that they really have the need for the XK that they once did. The F-Type is a fabulous little sports car in its own right.
Is that the blue one that Ian drove in the video?
Oh, yes.
That's a sharp car. I have to agree with Jerry. It does bring a smile to my face.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, it does.
So there's something that we do, I think, agree with Jerry on.
One of our mutual friends.
It's just too bad Jerry's products don't bring a smile to mine.
Yeah, one of our mutual friends was at a dealer and almost walked out with one.
Oh, with the F?
Because as he was walking through, it was a Jag Land Rover dealer, and as he was walking by, they had an F-Type sitting outside, and somebody was revving it up.
that'll do it. That will do it.
Yeah, and he almost brought one home.
Yep. How much? Yeah, here you go.
He wasn't worried about
it. Here's a checkbook. Yeah, enjoy. That would be nice. So along those lines, while part of this article was that on the other side, you know, the Land Rover side, apparently they're not worried about the Bentley Bentayga. I'm saying that correctly. If I'm not saying it correctly, I apologize.
I think it's Bentayga.
Bentayga. Or the upcoming Rolls-Royce SUV. Land Rover has their autobiography editions and the Holland and Holland editions that will go over $200,000. Apparently, I like this is a great quote. Eberhardt, which I should have figured out who Mr. Eberhardt is. But he said they're sticking to their statements that last year that Land Rover will not introduce a separate nameplate above the Range Rover, saying, quote, "We define this segment, we own it, and we will defend it." And I thought that was really, true.
You ruin the brand if you try to introduce something even more premium.
Interesting. Well, yeah. They did that with the autobiography.
But that's a special edition. It's not like a separate brand.
True.
Right.
I guess you really don't need a Rolls-Royce Land Rover version because they already have it. You know, how are you going to sell? You're not going to sell.
Not enough to justify to justify ruining the Range Rover premium cachet already.
True.
I don't see Bentley or Rolls-Royce competing with Land Rover in this market. I don't see Land Rover having to compete with them. I see Rolls-Royce and Bentley trying to compete with Range Rover.
Absolutely.
So.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, and I found out Mr. Eberhardt is Joe, and he's the JLR North American CEO. So welcome, Joe. I agree with this comment that they defined the segment, and it's very much true. I mean, the Range Rover defined that starting back in, 1970? So there you go. So
they're still the one to beat.
That's it. They're setting the mark. Well, and they also can say this, going back to our first story, sales are great. Why do you need to change anything? You know, sales are continuing. They're selling, especially here in America, they're selling, you know, year over year. The sales are increasing at a nice double-digit increase. So of course you don't have to respond at all to those cars, because now that, because you know, Bentley sees that, Rolls-Royce sees that, they see these sales going and they want to capture that market. Land Rover's already there.
It's ironic to say this about a British brand, but it's not broken, don't fix it.
Well said, sir. Well said. Speaking of cars that are not to be broken, thanks for the segue, they took and chopped off part of the Avoc and have created a convertible. So they, in 2017, coming, there's a first drive from Autoblog. If you want to check that out, of course, check our show notes. Pretty much they like the car, not surprisingly, it for what it is. And they, looks like the Land Rover added about 600 pounds to the car, but it's still pretty zippy. And gets does what it needs to do, and I liked. It was interesting that they talk about the production of the car, and then they, you know, all the cars go through the same production line, except for the Avoc convertible. It takes, I forget what they said, something like 8 hours to produce the car, and it takes 8 hours and 26 minutes to produce the Avoc, because they take the Avocs, they're going to, they go to a special area and they get fitted with the top, and some other things are added to the car, and it takes 26 minutes to produce those cars. But I guess they're ramping up production right now, getting those cars ready to go. They're going to go for sale in the summer here in North America. So if you want an Avoc.
Well, 600 pounds isn't that shocking. I mean, convertibles are typically heavier, so.
Right. Well, you have to put back some structure, so it's, yeah. So it's not uncommon to add, yeah, at least that much.
Stiffen them up. And
yeah.
Yeah, they add some things to the car, as you said, stiffen it up and all that business.
Right, because the roof is a structural member in any unibody, and when you take that away, you lose the fourth side of your box, so you have to triangulate everything else.
The canvas roof unfurls in 18 seconds and will deploy at speeds up to 30 miles per hour. And it's,
in case you're too impatient to do it before you leave.
Right, exactly. Yes. Or just my recommendation would be just buy a series truck and the canvas will come off for you.
Well,
just go down the
go.
Highway at 40 miles an hour, the wind gets in behind it, and it'll pull it off for you.
Is there a story behind this, John? Any recent happenings?
last year, the canvas stop on the Series 3, just the air was getting in the gaps right at the door. And just
gaps? Really? Gaps?
Well,
there are gaps in a series truck?
Bigger
gaps. Gaps. Air, birds, small animals.
Pails of water.
Yeah.
You know. So the air, I'm in the driver's seat, and then, of course, what you know, it's the opposite one on the passenger side, and I'm going down I-70, and the cold, it's in February, the cold air is coming in, and just, and it opens that flap up, and then cold air rushing, you know, that's all. So that's why, yeah. You want to deploy, just drive a series truck. It'll automatically, the canvas top will clear itself for you, right? Also coming up new, they are refreshing the Range Rover itself, the main Range Rover. It's coming up for a major refresh in, I guess, 17-18 model year, or excuse me, 18-19 model year. But for 17 model year, they are doing some minor updates. So if you want to check out the changes, which apparently are just going to be, I think, bumpers from the looks of it, that's out there. And maybe I think they're not sure yet what's happening internally, if they're doing any mechanical changes or any internal changes. So. That's the Range Rover update.
Yeah, it's a pretty spiffy development camo they've got in the picture there.
I do like that camo. It's pretty,
I really wish they'd offer stuff like that as an optional color, just you be able like to get that. Them in development camo.
Is this the black, white, and gray?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, that is always pretty cool.
This one's swirly, though.
It's sort of paisley, if you will.
Yes, a lot of times they do the big blocks. They'll do, and this one, though, is kind of very swirly.
Actually,
oh, yeah,
you know,
I like
look,
that.
If you look at it in the right chart. Light, it kind of looks like a swarm of raccoons.
A swarm of raccoons. I think we might have a show name. A swarm of raccoons. I like that. That's pretty much the news for today. So we had one. There wasn't much news in the last month. Sales are doing very well. Land Rover's continuing down, marching down its path that it's going, and new cars are coming out seemingly every other day. The refreshes are going on and happening, and we have no idea what's happening with the new Defender yet, but it's coming. But this is
it's coming, and we're gonna like it.
I think you were being sarcastic, sir.
Really? You didn't see the big blinking light?
your blinking light works?
Yeah.
Okay. So here's a kind of an interesting and this is a groaner. No one here is going to think this, there's anything wrong about this or be, you know, questioning what happened here. But there's a story out here, and I'll have a link in the show notes, but it was on this Quora website. How does it feel to lose a very expensive car? And so the gentleman pipes in and says that he had a 1995 Defender 90, and there's a picture of it, and he sold it, and immediately, I mean, even immediately, he actually cried the next day. I wanted it back bad, and it was gone. And, of course, now they're selling for, you know, they're selling for $100,000 now.
I want to hear from any of our listeners who has ever sold a Defender and not regretted getting rid of it.
Or almost any Land Rover you had. I mean,
well, sure. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Expand the search. Any of our listeners out there ever sold a Land Rover and not regretted getting rid of it?
Yes.
Not? Okay. I guess that leaves me out. I've regretted them all.
Exactly.
I just got rid of Crazy Red, and it hurts.
Yeah.
Sam DeLong, I know you probably don't listen to this podcast, but you should.
I still pine for the Freelander. It's just
we know where to find the Freelander.
I'm still allowed to pine for it.
Would you like the crumpled wad back?
I was going to say, I know the owner is willing to part with it.
I can shove it into your yard in the middle of the night sometime.
That's good. I'm happy. I can go visit it when
I could even drop another tree on it.
Chimney.
Yeah, we'll simulate with trees.
So that's the news for the month. Hopefully next month there may be more news to talk about. When we come back from the podcast, we are going to talk with Dave about the Maine winter romp.
Woohoo!
Welcome back to the Center Steer podcast for March of 2016. It is now time for our Trail Rides events segment. And just happened in February was the Maine Winter Romp, which takes place in Maine, United States. I was trying to scroll so I could find the actual name of the town.
Waterville and Benton.
There we go. It takes place in Waterville and Benton, Maine. Before we ask Dave to give us a personal recap of what happened, I invite you to go check out the article that we'll have in the show notes. It's out on Atlantic British's website called by Dave Bobeck, called A Winter's Romp Tale. And we give a little shout out also to our friend and member of our local Land Rover club. We call him King Bill. You can see his Green Series 3 out
there. All hail the king.
So that's out there. Trying to come up here in the next couple months, our various, we're starting to get into, of course, the trail riding season, event season. Mars coming up in October, which I know it's just spring, but man, October's going to hit here very quickly. And I have been in touch with the organizers of Mars, hopefully going to get them on the show here soon to talk more about Mar. In our local area, we got the Pittsburgh Vintage Grand Prix coming up, and I did post an article out on our Facebook page and also on Twitter about the Pittsburgh Vintage Grand Prix event. It was actually a pretty neat read. So I invite you to check that out if you understand what the event's all about.
It's now in its, what, 35th year or something like that?
Sounds about right. Yeah, it's been a while. And all the nice things, all the proceeds go to
the Allegheny Valley School.
Autism?
Which is a school for autistic.
And I think it's like $15 million or something in the last 30 years. I mean, all that money goes to that. So, anyways, there's events coming up. Of course, there's all the stuff that goes on in the UK, which, you know, we need a UK correspondent, but we don't have one at the moment. So
any of you, our UK listeners out there, if you want the job, send us your resume.
There we go. Yes, CV, sir. Yes. But right now, let's talk to Dave about the Maine Winter Romp. Dave, what do you have to tell us about the event?
Well, this year, it was a little warmer than usual leading up to the romp.
Well, by the way, where is it Waterville? Is that what part of Maine? Is it very north?
It's central Maine.
Central, okay.
It's not outrageously far north, although you're north of Toronto.
Really?
Yeah.
Latitude, longitude kind of thing?
You are north of Toronto when you're in Waterville. So
Toronto. You got to shorten and say Toronto.
The actual off-roading takes place centered around Bruce Fowler's property, although not necessarily all on Bruce's property, in Benton, Maine, which is a neighboring community. And quite honestly, I mean, it's epic. Some of the wonder of the trip is simply getting there. You know, coming from southwestern Pennsylvania, round trip, it was a little over 2,100 miles.
Wow.
So I chose to trailer my truck up.
You cheated.
Yes, I did.
I think a lot of people cheat and trailer up there.
Well, there are a lot of trailers in the parking lot. That is true. But there's an awful lot of people that roll up there right in their truck. But they're not coming, you know, almost 900 miles each way. So.
Well, interesting note. I just happen to know that it's like 2,000 miles out to Vegas from Pittsburgh.
Yep. So that's just for point of reference. That's the kind of distances you're talking about. And this year was a little interesting for me because I just bought a new truck capable of towing my Rover. And I decided that I was taking my kids with me for the first time. I've always driven up. This was the third time I've been to Winter Romp. I've been trying to go every other year. And it's always in the past two times that we've gone, it was just myself and my wife. So we were able to pack the disco full of anything and everything we thought that we might possibly need.
Plus a little bit, just in case.
Yes. And in some cases, we have needed the extra stuff. Sadly, all that extra stuff took up the space that would have been occupied by my kids. It was very cold. The trails were...
But it was warmer than last year, correct? And less snow.
Well, it was warmer leading up to the romp, but the days of the actual romp, it was brutally cold. Like, teens, the first day, starting off overnight, temps were below zero.
Yikes.
That's cold.
Sunday morning, when we got up to start heading home, I want to say it was 12 below.
Yikes.
That's cold.
Yeah.
Now, where do you stay? Are you camping? Are you in a hotel?
There are people that camp every year. I always, every year that I begin planning this trip, I think to myself, God, I want to camp. But I also think about how tired I am after camping for a weekend and wheeling. And looking at, you know, 12 to 16 hours driving home, I'm good at falling asleep at the wheel. So I always opt to stay in the hotel just because I need the extra sleep. But it is an option to camp.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to have to drive home after that for sure. It does drain your energy to sleep in the cold like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I'm always just afraid that I'm going to get in the truck and it's going to warm up.
You could always turn the heat off, roll the windows down.
Yeah, I guess that would keep you awake. At least for a while.
Doesn't shock your body with the 90-degree temperature swing.
Well, you have to be prepared for anything in Maine, so, you know.
Well, you don't have to, but it helps.
Hey, if you want to survive, you pretty much have to. So, we wheeled. It was all good. I wheeled almost exclusively on Friday. Saturday, the guys from Lucky 8, there's a power line that you cross as you enter the trail system. And most of these trails are usually, they look like they're usually snowmobile trails. But they're all centered and, you know, everything in Maine is kind of damp. You know, there's a lot of peat bogs and places. Well, this power line that you cross coming in is one of the big trails that everybody likes to run. Well, something I learned this year was that because it was warm, it never froze. So what I always thought was dry ground leading up to this big hill and this power line turned out to be 4 or 4.5 feet of muck. And we watched people all day Saturday drop their trucks into the door handles and then spend, you know, an awful lot of time trying to get out.
At least they weren't trying to cross a peat bog. That can be spectacular when you break through that.
Oh, yeah.
Who'd you wheel with?
I wheeled with Dave Bobeck and Bill Fischel on Friday. And Saturday, I hung out with the Lucky Eight guys in their coffee house tent because it was a lot colder Saturday and there were a lot more people. And I figured that there was going to be a lot of people sitting stuck on the trails.
So was this like acoustic guitars and poetry kind of coffee house or what?
No. This was more eyeing up each other's rovers and trying to figure out which parts we could get off before anybody noticed.
Oh, so just any other meeting, in other words.
Yeah, but they had coffee.
All right.
How many trucks do you estimate? How many people showed up for the event?
In excess of 100. I haven't seen an official count.
Yeah, I think there was. I thought I saw 150 in the article, but
I don't know if it was 150, but.
And then how much is it?
It doesn't cost anything. I mean, it costs what you pay to get there, and you know what you pay to eat different places, and
yeah, a lot of events,
and what the replacement parts cost you.
Yeah, and what the replacement parts cost you. I made it home with only a broken taillight.
Sorry about that.
So, there's lots of eating at Big G's Deli. It was interesting. Here's a story for you. My wife was talking to the people in Big G's on Friday, and apparently they were surprised because they didn't realize there would be so many people there on Friday. They're prepared for Saturday. And they were talking to the owner of Big G's, and he was telling us that this is their Super Bowl. The main winter romp is Big G's Super Bowl. You can take off any other day during the year.
For those of our listeners around the world, and that would be like the World Cup.
Yes. You can take off any other day of the year. But the Saturday of main winter romp, you better be at work. They have all hands on deck.
Well, this is the 20th year of this event. Is that
yes.
Correct? And so and it's been building over the years. More and more people are showing up, coming from all parts of especially eastern United States to the event.
Right. And they sell out all of the hotels. My understanding was that every hotel in Waterville, Maine was sold out.
How many hotels are there in Waterville, Maine?
Two or three at least.
Okay.
So both hotels are booked up.
Yeah, there's a Fireside Inn, which is I don't know who owns the chain, but and then there's a Best Western.
It's a college town, so there's actually more than I thought was referred to in the articles. They've referred to as a college town.
I would defer to Mr. Bobeck on that.
Fair enough. We should try to get him on the show.
Yes, we should.
The various events. He actually has quite a history. So
yes, he spent lots of time towing me out of places that when after I discovered that my winch had decided to expire.
Do tell. This sounds like a good story. You should be telling us what happened.
We got onto a trail that didn't look all that bad, and I'm pretty sure that we'd come down it. It, you know, wasn't a big deal. And, you know, Dave was leading, and I was bringing up the rear, and we had Bill in the middle, and Bill got stuck, and we got Bill unstuck. And I ended up hung up in almost exactly the same place in my disco that was, you know, I mean, Bill's truck is pretty standard with the exception of the rear locker.
Yes, that the infamous rear air locker.
Yeah. I ended up stuck.
Notorious, perhaps.
In my truck with, you know, much bigger tires and all the fancy electricery and whatnot. I got stuck in the exact same spot.
There might be a moral to that story somewhere.
Yeah, don't follow Bill.
Although I see in the picture, Bill did put chains on. That's a first I've seen. I haven't seen Bill put chains on his truck before.
Oh, yeah. He's prepared.
That's good. So good for Bill.
Yeah, he was high-centered, and I followed him by hanging my rear diff on pretty much the same spot.
And
so
how'd you get out?
By the kind assistance of Mr. Bobeck. And rescuing me.
His winch?
Yes, and his winch. In his D90. So
is that what he drives? I didn't know that.
Yeah, he's got a light blue D90.
Is that
might very well be it.
Yes, podcast listeners, we're pointing at the screen. Clearly you can see which one I'm pointing at. It's actually under the camo truck. We think that's Dave's Bobeck's truck. So there's a camo picture of a camo truck.
You know what? I'm thinking that's not because Dave's got a high lift mounted on the back of his too.
Okay, That may then maybe it's not in, maybe he didn't include a photo.
Well,
he's being modest.
Oh, look, there's food though.
Oh, and there is lots of good food in Waterville, Maine. Let me tell you. The event, Bruce puts the event on, and you, there isn't a registration fee or anything because what you're doing is you're bringing business to town.
Right.
And the people in Maine all seem very happy to have you there. So
it's their annual Black Friday, if you will. It's their money, right?
Well, it certainly is a big geez, I'll tell you that.
Well, your hotels sell out, food sells out, yeah. So and gasoline and diesel, I'm sure, are used plentiful. So
yeah, I mean, there are a lot of people. I mean, Waterville is a notable. I mean, it's not some little backwater place. There's lots of people in Waterville, so I'm sure there are other things that happen.
Yeah,
but yeah, it's a big event for a lot of these places.
Sure, sure. Oh, Waterville is a city in Kennebec County in Maine. I see. We should probably do some pre-research on the podcast here. But heaven forbid we do that.
Service by 95. Interstate 95.
Well, I-95 is effectively the main turnpike. So.
Yeah. Well, yeah. That's the turnpike up the east coast of the United States. You can go all the way from Florida to Maine on I-95.
It'd be much like saying it's just off the M1.
Indeed. Indeed. So there you go. Okay. So you go every other year. Would you go back next year? Do you encourage folks to go? If they were to go, what do you suggest maybe a first-time visitor do to the events, which they bring or take with them?
I think you need to be prepared for brutally cold weather. I think you need to come prepared to self-recover. Bruce has a very, very good website for the event, and it clearly spells out the kind of equipment that you need to have in your vehicle.
Which we have had links on the show in the show before.
And, you know, you have to remember that there's no whining. Absolutely no whining.
There's no whining in...
There's no whining at all. If you take a look at the website,
is that like
you'll
there's no
I mean.
Crying in baseball?
That, yes. That's right. There's no whining at the winter romp.
Yes.
Suck it up, princess.
Do what you got to do. Yeah, I'm surprised Morgan hasn't gone because he doesn't live too far away. That's.
I think he's embarrassed by the lack of Rover at this point.
How close is Morgan to Killington?
They share a common state. Vermont ain't that big.
No, it's. I believe Morgan's up here near Burlington.
Oh, okay.
I'm not sure where Killington is. I don't.
No,
see
it's right in the middle of your screen.
Is it? Oh, okay. So then he not far.
I actually had a detour on the trip up there because my wife determined that we were going to make this a family trip, and we were going to do some educationally relevant things with my children.
Aha! Uh-huh.
So we left a day in advance and drove to Niagara Falls. And we saw Niagara Falls on a day when it was like, oh, I don't know, 4 or 5 degrees out, which
Fahrenheit
is an experience in that, you know, everything at the falls is covered in spray. Well,
if
you walk up there when it's 4 or 5 degrees out, you quickly get frozen.
Everything's covered and
yes.
It freezes immediately.
Yes. I mean, it was cold enough that it hurt.
How long did you stay outside looking at the falls? 4 seconds?
We walked out. I went, oh, the hell with this. And we turned around and walked back. And then we stopped by the Lucky 8 shop on the way to heckle those guys and tell them, we're out ahead of you.
Nice. So, was there any major problems at the winter romp? Any trucks break that you know of, or any major damages? No, but no one rolled their truck.
Well, Dave's truck froze solid one night. I want to say Friday night.
Oh, yeah, he mentioned
to the ground or internally fluid wise.
Maybe both.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah, they ended up wrapping it in a giant sheet of plastic and putting a heater underneath it and blowing heat underneath the truck until it got warm enough to start. I can tell you that Bill Fischel had, I want to say, 1030 motor oil in his series truck, and we bump started him one day and got it got the truck warmed up enough that he could drain the oil pan. He couldn't start the truck because the oil thickened up so much that it wouldn't allow the engine to turn over.
Yikes.
So we drained it, and we put much, like, I want to say it was like 520, something really thin in it.
Mm-hmm. Well, how did the modern trucks do? Any issues do you know of? Because, you know, those are severe conditions. That
honestly, my D2, I ran 1540 in it, and it kicked over every day like it didn't give a damn how cold it was.
No, they do test for that stuff. I mean, they check these vehicles out ahead of time, and they prepare for that.
Yeah. I mean, I worried about my diesel truck that I was using as my tow vehicle. Not a problem.
Not a problem, yeah.
It just...
I can imagine my Series 3 would have just frozen up, and yeah, I would have been there till it thawed out as much as I'd like to go.
Well, that's why everybody, when you come up in a group, you always want, you know, at least one guy that tows something.
Yeah, well, that's...
Because you could always drive my Disco home, and we'll just tow your...
Yeah, all the more reason why there's a lot of tow vehicles, because... Yeah, you know, especially the older ones are going to have problems.
Yeah.
And that severe condition.
One of the things I liked about the event is that people busted my chops for towing in. I think that all Rover events need people to bust other people's chops for towing their vehicle in. As much as I'm the guy towing in, I think that that's good. Because we got to keep these vehicles rolling under their own power. And I don't want a trailer queen. You know, I love my Disco and I like to drive it. And every time I get in it and drive it, I think, oh, this is awesome. So
I guess given that you only trailer it to certain events, that makes it a trailer princess?
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to say.
Any final thoughts, Dave, on the main winter romp?
I think it's awesome. I think everybody ought to try and get up there at least once.
There you go.
And it's been 20 years. I mean, I don't know how much longer Bruce is going to want to keep doing it. So
it takes place on his property, right? Mostly.
No.
I thought it did.
Well, some of it takes place on his property.
Okay.
And it's centered around his property, but it's actually up the road.
Oh, so it's expanded beyond his property. Well, that's good. Well, that's good. Well, obviously, bringing money and tourism into the area, the folks are going to be open to that. So,
yep.
Yeah, nice. Good deal.
So, and one other thing to note here. Beyond the main winter romp, I do want to note that, and maybe I shouldn't tell anybody about this, because it is my favorite event, and I love that it's small. But the Robazonia Spring Trials, which I still declare to be the best event in North America. Main Winter Romp is the best big event, if you ask me.
So tell, what is the Robazonia? Where does it take place? What happens there?
Robazonia is Robazonia, PA, which is
Central Pennsylvania.
And April 23rd and 24th, they will be hosting the semi-annual trials event that they have there. So check out roversclub.org under the events.
We'll have a link in the show notes.
To see what's going on there. It is, I kid you not, it is bar none most fun you will have.
Why do you say that? What makes it special and unique that you enjoy it so?
Oh, it's a very friendly competition. Generally speaking, you don't see many more than one truck moving at a time usually, because everybody's kept it small. And you know,
how many trucks or people?
I don't think I've ever been there when there have been more than 20.
Oh, that's
I mean, and it's a trials event, so
right.
You stand around, you watch the first guy go through, and you know, then try to.
How much does it cost?
I'd say 25, maybe 30.
Is there camping on site, or do you stay at hotels?
There is camping on site if you choose to camp. I've actually never camped there, although I've shown up every time intending to.
So
the last time I was there was last spring, whenever I hauled back your sand ladders.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So
part of the Rover Underground.
Yes.
So do you stay at a hotel, or do you?
I drive out there really late at night to sleep in the truck and.
Okay.
That's called camping,
Dave.
Well, I went to the truck stop. I wouldn't call it camping. But.
I see. Well, the Bells do it all the time.
Yeah.
They live that way.
That's right.
But their truck is set up to do it that way. My truck, I'm sleeping in the driver's seat.
Well, you electrically lean it back, though, right?
Yeah, more or less.
More or less, yeah.
Well, he's got a long way to go home if that doesn't come back up again.
True.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
So, Robesonia, we'll have a link in the show notes. It's coming up in
April,
less than a month.
April 23rd, and 24th.
Are you going this year?
It is my intent.
Good. So, and if any podcast listeners go, check out Dave. Did anybody say hi to you at the Winter
Not Rock? A single one.
We have no podcast listeners that went to the Winter Rock.
So, no trophies
well,
for
other
you.
Than me.
Well, yes, but you're more than a listener, Dave. So you're contributor status, sir.
Oh dear.
Yes, and I think I have something more I can give away now. If anyone ever sees you or sees one of us and they're at an event,
I was going to say I still have the prize from Winter Romp. We'll
yeah, exactly.
That.
Yeah.
This could be an ever growing jackpot.
I know exactly.
The center steer Powerball.
I was going to say I do have that bag and
true. Hey, the bag was cool too. Yeah. Yeah, there you go. So, all right. So, check as if you've tracked down Dave at an event, say hi, or see one of us at an event, say hello. Maybe we'll have something for you. Maybe we won't. Who knows?
Yeah, we do. I mean, we had a significant presence there. It was me and Jeff Aronson. So.
Yeah. Oh, Jeff. Oh, hey. There you go. Hi, Jeff.
So we need to have like a broadcast from there sometime.
Oh, we could probably swing something, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, we can always do that. All right. So that's our trail update. If any of our listeners have trails they want to update us on, if you've been to a trail, maybe somewhere around the world that's interesting and you want to talk about it, let me know. We'll get you on the show. Maybe we'll hear about your experience at some event somewhere else, maybe beyond North America. Because as I look at our listeners, they literally are around the world. There's people listening from around the world. So we'd like to hear about events beyond North America. All right, we will come back.
For the past few years, my wife has been living in California, taking care of her aging parents. It's an incredibly difficult, stressful, and thankless job that she does willingly. I could never do what she does. The long hours, lack of sleep, and sometimes hostile environment would quickly rob me of my sanity. All I can do is be supportive, to be a listening ear on the telephone, and to share a little bit of my life so that she could still feel some sort of connection to the place that she used to call home. I now have a great deal of understanding and empathy for the families of our intrepid armed forces. These brave soldiers are away from their family and friends for months, sometimes years at a time, often far away in a land where they don't feel welcome because the locals think they're doing just fine on their own, and they don't need any help from outsiders. Unfortunately, for elderly people suffering from dementia, they often don't realize that their cognitive dysfunction and memory loss are a threat to their own safety, and they do, in fact, need help. They often get frustrated with their situation and express this frustration as anger directed at their caregiver. Like the unwanted soldier in a strange land, my wife, the caregiver, is constantly underappreciated and sleep-deprived. She begins each day not knowing what will go wrong next. All she knows is that she won't see it coming, and she will get blamed for it. Earlier this month, she was finally able to arrange for a few days of leave, and we spent some time together for the first time in a year and a half. We took care of some important business, we did a few projects around the house, and she was able to catch up with many of her friends. We also tried to make sure she ate and slept as well as possible, so that her batteries were fully charged when the time came to redeploy. In addition, I also tried to impart to my workaholic wife the therapeutic benefits of wasting time. I remember several years ago I was reading a book on time management that advocated wasting time as a productivity tool. The reasoning was that goofing off for a few minutes relieved stress and improved focus. The author also believed that this made him feel a little guilty and compelled him to push a little harder when returning to work. I'm not sure I buy into the guilt theory, but I do believe the brain can come cluttered from excess input. Momentarily shutting off the input allows the brain to clear out some of the clutter, in much the same way that turning off a faucet allows the water to clear out of a slow-moving drain. By the end of the day, my brain can become so full of information that I really need to shut it off for a while. If not, I'm awake all night solving problems and building stuff in my mind. While this may seem like a gift, it really becomes a curse when it leads to involuntary sleep deprivation. Unwinding with an hour or two of mindless television is really a vital part of my daily health routine. I sleep better. I live longer. It's as simple as that. On the other hand, like many other things with medicinal qualities, wasting too much time can have detrimental effects. Use sparingly, as needed, and when in doubt, consult a professional. A few days ago, Microsoft launched an artificial intelligence project named Tay. It's a so-called chatbot designed to interact with social media websites. The purpose was to learn more about millennials and how they speak, presumably to improve the new Cortana interface. It was an interesting experiment that only lasted less than 24 hours. Microsoft had to pull the plug quickly after Tay began tweeting out racist rants and statements in favor of Adolf Hitler. It's not like Tay figured this out through complex, in-depth analysis of Western civilization. Millennials with nothing else to do wasted a lot of time teaching Tay to say these things. Like teaching a 5-year-old to swear in church, it's disruptive to most, offensive to some, and really not very funny. The problem is that artificial intelligence is just that. It's artificial, not real. Like little kids, they listen to and repeat everything you say. Like sociopaths, they have no conscience and no ability to differentiate right from wrong. And like the famous Terminator, it can't be reasoned with, it can't be bargained with, and it doesn't know pain or pity or remorse. Call me crazy, but advances in artificial intelligence could eventually make computers smarter than humans. And when that day comes, I would really prefer it if we, the people, had not taught the machines that genocide is a good way to purify the master race. So to all you millennial age slackers out there, it's time to put down your devices and come out of your parents' basement. It's time to go out, get a job, and become a productive member of society. You've wasted enough time already. And to all you parents out there dealing with the basement-dwelling slacker infestation, you need to recognize your contribution to the problem. Stop feeding and housing them for free. Help them find a job and a new place to live. Teach them responsibility and the value of work. Better yet, get them hooked on old Land Rovers. They're good fun for the whole family, and that's not a waste of time at all. Okay, by now I think I've wasted enough of your time, so let's get back to the rest of the podcast.
The Centers to Your Podcast is proud to have our first sponsor, LTW Knives. LTW Knives are handcrafted in Ohio with the finest locally sourced materials. They build everything from everyday carry to bushcraft and even overland specific. Everything that LTWK builds comes with a lifetime guarantee and is designed from the ground up to be a solid working knife. Each piece is constructed with survival in mind. Knives with a proven international pedigree that have been there and back. Bushcraft, hunting, camping, overland, and everyday carry models are available. Our new Bushcrafter HC is an excellent example of an everyman knife, able to do everything from help get the campfire started to skinning game. Being made from 3/32 1075 steel and with a convex edge, it will resharpen easily in the field. These heirloom quality pieces will outlast your adventure, so plan well, drive safely, and carry an LTWK. Find out more online at ltwrightknives.com or centersteer.com/LTWK.
Welcome back to the Center Steer Podcast. And as we talked last month with our guest, Mike Bishop, who is the author of They Found Our Engineer, Arthur Goddard, Land Rover's first engineer. He's a senior instructor at the Land Rover Experience, and he was also the project lead for the Celebration Line. Welcome back to the show, Mike. And last month, we talked about the book and Mr. Goddard and how that all came about. Basically, that was the hobby that you were involved in, and you seem to have turned that into a career. And that's what I think this month we're going to talk about, is how you moved into a career with Land Rovers.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, it was. I hadn't planned that move, but it was.
We're jealous, by the way, for the record. You know, all of us are jealous.
Yes.
I should say that.
We hate you.
in the nicest way.
No, it was once again, it was the seeds for that story were really, sown back in the 1990s with the 1948 to 1953 Land Rover Register. And I'd come across for the 50th anniversary, and a friend of mine who had happened to bought Land Rover number 16, pre-production number 16. We'd become good mates through a model called Land Rover Mobile Welder, which is only six in existence. We've both got mobile welders, really. You know, I've got both got 1949-50 model Land Rover welders, which are, you know, super rare, way rarer than a pre-production Land Rover. But that's another story. But he bought this, you know, number 16, and he worked in the oil industry in the UK. And so he's always, you know, working offshore and onshore, and got to the point where, you know, he needed to put the vehicle together. And so invited me to come over and put Land Rover number 16 together, of which I said, of course, because once again, I was only about 24 or 25 at the time. And it seemed like a perfectly, you know, normal, you know, thing to do. Just go go and hang out and put this rare car together.
Sure, of course.
And what ultimately happened was we took the vehicle to the 50th anniversary Series 1 Club event, and he happened to meet his future wife-to-be at that event. So that changed the plan ever so slightly on number 16, is that he and his future wife, they ran off and did coupley stuff. And I was just left in the shed with number 16 and a whole pile of tools and a whole pile of restored parts. And
you had your own couple.
Yeah, bolted it all together and put it all together. And that was great. We took it on this this run to Switzerland in the, for the 50th anniversary, which was a rerun of a prototype test they did with the, you know, in 1948, and came back, and you know, Richard went off and had a, you know, had a family, and you know, everything was great. But it, in doing all that stuff, and you know, the way his life went, it meant that his Land Rover sat in the shed for quite a while. And for some reason, I still don't quite completely understand to this day, he got in touch at around the 60th anniversary and said, oh, would you like to buy number 16? And I was like, yeah, of course I would. And we happened to be moving over to the UK, so it sort of worked. Yeah, I took it on, and it always sort of felt a little bit like my vehicle. And he said, yeah, it always, because he didn't put it together, you know, it felt, you know, like it wasn't entirely his vehicle. And yeah, he let it go, which I think he regrets still to this day. But that was that. Anyway, because nobody really, 16 has this, in, you know, has a pretty incredible history, and I don't think anybody had really taken the time to look into it too closely, but it spent all of its working life at Solihull, at the factory, and had run around on trade plates. It had never been formally registered, road registered. The plate number was 260AC, and AC being a Warwickshire number, you'll see, you know, AC and NX and UE and all that within the company vehicles in their registration sequence. And because of that, it was quite well known. And its first job when it was produced was one of the vehicles on the first stand when the vehicle was launched in the UK at the Bath and West show. They launched it at the in the UK there, and 16 was one of the vehicles on that stand in late May 1948. So, yeah, she introduced the Land Rover. She then went on to be the service department vehicle, and so it was a long-term test vehicle, and she ran around at the service department for, you know, a couple of decades, and became very much loved by, you know, all and sundry, because everyone got to drive her and that. And I wanted to find out more about this, more about these stories, about, you know, what had happened to the vehicle, because there was, you know, various other little myths about it. You know, this bit had been taken off and that bit had been taken off because of this reason and that reason. And until you find somebody or find a photograph, you don't really know. And so I was, you know, determined to find that out. So once the 60th anniversary had come and gone, I decided to go down to, you know, I had a day off one day, just go down to the what is now the British Motor Museum, was British Motor Industry Heritage Trust at Gaydon, and have a look at the archives. And I know the people in there reasonably well, and went in and said, oh, look, I'm looking for this photo of this vehicle, which won't really be the subject of the photo. It'll be in the background. And they sort of looked at me as to say, Mike, you are crazy. You know, you're absolutely barking mad trying to find that. You'll never find it. And I said, well, if you give me all the photos, eventually I'll find it, because all of these old engineering photographs, there's the subject of the photo, which is whatever vehicle it is. It can be a Rover car or a Land Rover or whatever. But, of course, there's all these other cars in the background, and I always thought there'd be a photo. If it's a service department, there's going to be a photo of it parked up somewhere in the background where they've, used it to tow the vehicle in or done something. And poor Jan, who's the front lady for that, she looked at me and she said, have you asked Roger? And I said, no, I haven't asked Roger. And she meant, of course, Roger Craythorne. And at the time I said, oh, look, he must be far too busy to, put up with, a crazy enthusiast like me who's, sort of trying to find the impossible. And she said, no, he's just here, 15 minutes ago. I'll give him a call. He'll come down and see you. And I said, well, okay, if he's here, it's not out of his way. So she rang him up. And Julie came down in about 10 minutes and he marched into the room. He had he was showing a journalist around because he worked for Land Rover PR at the time. And he came up with this incredible look on his face of, not quite believing, the story he'd heard, which was there was an Australian who claimed to have the 16th Land Rover. And he walked up and he said, so, introduced myself. And he said, so you got Land Rover number 16. And, of course, not saying yes, no, or anything like that. I just asked him a question back. And the question was, does the trade plate 260AC mean anything to you? And the look came across his face as though I'd sort of punched him in the face. He was of absolute shock. And he looked and he said, that's the vehicle I learned to drive off-road on. The service department vehicle. I said, yeah, that's it, the blue hardtop. And he's like, you've got it. And we started talking about it and, what had happened to the vehicle. And of course, he'd started work at Land Rover in around about 1963. And all the apprentices, when you had the summer holiday shutdown, the apprentices stayed on and they would go and repaint the offices and repaint all the toilets and do all this. And, of course, they'd use the service department vehicle to go and take stuff to the rubbish dump and do all these kind of things. So Roger was driving around one day and the person who was sitting beside him said, oh, you ever driven a Land Rover off-road before? And he's like, no. And they said, well, this is easy. They took the trailer off and put it into low range and started driving around sort of where Land Rover Experience is now. In Sully Hull, and he was hooked. He loved it, absolutely, in awe of what the vehicle could do off-road, and because that was number 16. Wow. So we became good friends, and then I showed him some photos of the vehicle before it was restored and everything. It's definitely no doubt about it. And I ended up finding a couple of photos of it, but I also ended up finding some footage of it running around at an event, which was the first Land Rover Owners Club meeting at Sully Hull in about 1957. So, yeah, the stories about it being, everybody's Land Rover, it's true.
And now it's your Land Rover.
Well, it's kind of still everybody's Land Rover, I consider. It's partly mine. I mean, one thing I did insist at the, when we bought it, just in case we ever had to go back to Australia quickly, I got a friend as a partner in it. So it's also Julian's Land Rover as well, even though Julian has his own collection, so it doesn't really spend terribly much time with poor old Julian. even though my wife would say, always says to me, oh, come on, it's Julian needs a drive now. But Julian took it to the Goodwood. We had an event at Goodwood this year and I got Julian to take it, that takes 16 there as his Land Rover. So he does get a drive. But when it was being restored Ken Wheelwright was restoring number 12 at the same time. So number 12 and number 16's rear bodies were restored at the same time. So Ken did those. So it sort of still has always remained sort of everybody's Land Rover in a strange kind of way. That's part of its character. Mm-hmm. Everyone gets to have a piece in it. And with a vehicle like that, you never really truly own it. You're just a custodian of it.
That's true.
Yeah, we call that stewardship.
Yeah, stewardship. Yeah, yeah.
Is that your daily driver?
You've got to be kidding. No, she's She's only just been at the factory. Only got a, because she was obviously up there for the end of Defender event. I wanted her to be part of that event, having been, you know, the UK launch on the first day. I wanted her to be there on the last day. So, yeah, she's usually, because of the story with Roger and everything, she's often not there. And, yeah, I only got her back, brought her back from there about 2 weeks ago. And, I live about 30 miles from Sully Hill, so I just drive her to work and drive her back home. That's where the way it gets done. So, which is good because it keeps her nice and reliable, it does. Yeah.
They must be driven, yes.
Yeah. Old vehicles to keep them, you know, at their best, you got to drive them. And if you, you know, and also drive them, you know, within, you know, well within their performance range. So, you know, I jump on the highway, on the motorway to drive it to work. You know, it goes along flat out with the trucks. So if anybody ever, you know, if she's ever at work and a journalist sort of says, oh, what's it like to go in this vehicle? You say, okay, well, let's go for a little bit of a drive. And they're like, oh, they can see that actually, the engineers did get them right on day one. Yeah.
I'm trying to decide which is more cool, that Roger Craythorn learned how to off-road in that truck or that Roger Craythorn used it as a garbage truck once.
I know. It's an incredible story, isn't it? It's insane. So what happened to number 16 after that is, in the 1970s, once she'd sort of had her first working life and got put aside, there was this, in the bad days of the motor industry when British Leyland was, you know, sort of, you know, it's, you know, the height of its, you know, demise, there were people who were, of course, trying to save things around, and there was some management, and they were trying desperately to save prototypes and unusual and interesting things. And, you know, at this point they didn't, everyone had forgotten that 16 was a pre-production, full pre-production Land Rover, and got put in this cage with all these other interesting vehicles. And two things happened. Firstly, there was a chap called Jeff Leather, who was a member of this club that I was in. He worked for the architects who worked for Land Rover. And he'd gone over there to Sully Hill to do some architecture, you know, quoting and work and measuring. And he'd come across this cage, everyone knew about this cage, and got into it and had a look at this Land Rover and lifted the bonnet and, of course, found the chassis number and was like, couldn't believe it. And instantly sort of tried to string together a plan to get it out and buy it, which is easier said than done. Even back then it was really, really difficult to get something unusual out. You know, it's almost impossible today unless you're, you know, it's going into a museum. Those days equally as hard. And what happened was, as the company was, you know, sort of, I suppose, divorced from British Leyland and became Land Rover Limited, all this stuff was cleared up, and, you know, stuff that needed to go in the museum went to the museum, and stuff that went together, what didn't need to go to the museum went to the scrapyard. And a chap called Harold Dovey, who was the jig shop foreman, the tool jigs, you know, making all the tooling for production lines and prototypes and stuff, he bought number 16 just as a Land Rover. He didn't realise what it was at all, for his son to run around it. Because his son was sort of coming of driving age and thought he could, you know, run around and learn to off-road.
Something for the kids to beat on.
Exactly. So they got it home and they started to pull it apart, him and his son, and he realised what it was. It was like, this is, you know, far too good a vehicle to, an important a vehicle to wreck, you know, just by, you know, letting his kids, you know, mess about in it. This chap, Jeff Leather, in his search of trying to find a way in, had come across and got to know a couple of people within the company, within engineering. And there was a chap who lived near his holiday house, who was in engineering and used to bring home, you know, early vehicles and interesting vehicles. And of course, this, between, you know, the three of them, they worked out, you know, where 16 was. You know, obviously it was at the jig shop foreman's place, and, you know, they a deal was struck together, and, you know, the Leathers got hold of number 16 that way. So Jeff's son started to restore the vehicle and got to a point where he had a young family and decided to to sell it on to help fund an extension to his house, and that's when Richard got it, and Richard sort of continued the restoration, and obviously got Ken Wheelwright involved and John Taylor involved on some other bits. He's another well-known restorer over here, and various other people, and then me to come and put it together. And yeah, that's number 16.
So it is it's finally road legal. Also, it got titled at some point. Yeah.
What happened? One thing is one quite funny story that happened is it ended up with a number plate, HNX331, which isn't its original number, but in the 1980s, they had this number plate amnesty over here in the UK where people could, the way the system works over here is, quite unique.
Right.
And people like to keep their numbers or their original numbers because of this little coding within the sequence, like the AC meaning Warwickshire or the UE meaning Warwickshire in the case of Huey. So people are really, quite intent on keeping their original numbers. And, all these people had all these old cars. They started applying for numbers. And the researcher at the time, a guy called Tony Hutchings, who wrote Lander of the Early Years, he made a mistake. And he thought 16 was registered HNX331, but it wasn't. So, it's got F. Yeah, I can't remember the chassis number of the vehicle that really was HNX331. But if it turns up, there's going to be an interesting situation. But we know where it all is now. Where we can prove that. So it's not a huge problem.
So how did you parlay all this then into being the instructor for Land Rover Experience?
So once I got to know Roger, and obviously I was doing Arthur turned up, not that long after, I got to know Roger, probably within a year. And we started running around the company trying to, all these stories that Arthur was telling us about, center steer and engineering and ideas and everything. We were trying to, of course, prove it all. They all find elements of it. And so we spent a lot of time together talking, working, looking for stuff, going through old archives, going through old engineering records. And one day Roger jumped on the phone and he said, can you come over to Sully Hill and help me out with some ideas for a film shoot for the BBC? They've got a series called Coast. And it's an hour-long television series, and they go around the UK coast and they tell stories of interesting pieces of history that happened on that coastline or that rock or that piece of sand or whatever. And they were doing one about Anglesey and Red Wharf Bay and, of course, the famous drawing in the sand, which Maurice Wilkes did. And, there was other historians who weren't available. I think James Taylor was, he was busy, he was away. Some of the others that they used were away. So Roger said, can you come along on this? And I ended up on this BBC film shoot as being one of the experts. And what we did was we took Huey along and we took number 16. And number 16, we took the body off it and showed how, the chassis, which is, in the Defender's case, or what was started off as the original Land Rover, the series vehicle, is really the platform of the vehicle. And that chassis, you can develop it into almost anything due to its strength and its rigidity. And so suddenly I found myself on international television, which was kind of cool. But the other really cool part was because we took all the vehicles there on the Land Rover Experience truck, and I got to know the truck driver, Don, he's still with the company. He'd been a truck driver for the company for about 45 years. And he was a development driver on Discovery One and on P-38 Range Rover, and he's done all this stuff. And we just got into that truck and we just talked and talked and talked the whole time, and parked at Beau Morris there in Anglesey, and because you couldn't get the truck to Red Wharf Bay, so we had to drive Huey and number 16 there. And it's probably about a 6 or 7 mile drive. So suddenly you're driving Huey down the road for 6 or 7 miles. It's crazy. And I was like, Don, that was really, really cool fun. That was such good fun. And he said, you should, join Land Rover Experience and just continue having the fun. And I just thought, yeah, why not? You know, because what I had been working on had dried up and taken it, you know, a turn. Some people had bought it and wanted to take it in a different direction. And yeah, so I got in touch with the chap who the bloke who looks after it, and you know, said, he just asked, is there any opportunities? And he'd heard of me by this point. And he said, if you can pass your instructor training, yeah, we'll look into seeing if you can become an LRE instructor. And it was just at the time that Range Rover Evoque had been launched. So everything at JLR was starting to, you know, ramp up again after the global financial crisis. So it was a good opportunity, good point to join.
What is the test that you have to take?
Oh, it's you have to become a full off-road instructor. It's not for the faint-hearted. Obviously, you have to be good as an off-road driver, and safe, and you know, practical. But you have to be able to explain it to people, and teach it to them. And that's another skill within itself, because mm-hmm. you can go around and you can drive around. And you can know how something's working, but can you explain it to somebody? And can you explain it? Okay, can you explain how a differential in a car actually works to somebody who has absolutely no mechanical knowledge? And that's what you've got to be able to do.
Right.
Break it right down to the simplest possible form of saying to someone, okay, we're at the top of this hill. We're going to go down that really steep hill there. Okay, so this is how we're going to set up the vehicle. It's going to be in low range. It's going to have the diff locked. It's going to be in first gear. And this is what will happen. And when they sit there and they say, why, how do you know? And they start asking questions. Of course, you've got to be able to answer those questions to them to keep them safe within the vehicle. And if they don't know, any engineering terms or, you know, what, you know, the word torque means or, mm-hmm. you know, any of that stuff, then you've got to break it down to really simple levels, you know. And that's what the true skill in instructing is.
Right, right. So you became an instructor in 2011?
Yeah, instructor in 2011.
Okay.
And that led
to the Celebration Line project lead?
Yeah, that did in a long kind of way. So when I joined LRE Solihull, it was the centre with its famous tracks, the Jungle Track and the Adventure Zone and the Land Track. Land Track is where the 110 was launched back in 1983. Jungle Track has obviously been around for such a long time, since about 1954, from Arthur's era, and they had the factory tour, and I started doing those, and I realised it was going to be a really good opportunity to get to know people within the company, because obviously, you know, corporate events, you know, mm-hmm. any events, any excuse, people always want to show people within the business the products and how they work, or show them the factory and how it works. And so I saw that opportunity and took it, and I went and did a couple of really big events. I did a Range Rover launch, full, you know, the current Range Rover in Morocco, and did a number of other big events. And of course, everyone sort of said, well, you know, Defender's going to stop sometime, you know, around 2015. So we should put together a tour, an event. And my boss, Zoe, she's a big enthusiast, and she wanted to do that. And of course, Roger had this idea for a long time of doing a replica production line of the original production line. So those two, you know, they'd worked together for such a long time. They started to sort of initially string this idea together, and got some of the creative involved. And the creative started Googling around the internet for stories and bits and pieces which hadn't been told, and suddenly came across a book called They Found Our Engineer. And
what do you know?
And Zoe said, well, he works for us. So suddenly, next thing you know, you're in there, and you got this project, and you got this project to lead, and what can we add new? Because there's no point in telling the same old story that everyone else has told, why don't we try and make it a little bit myth busting? Why don't we try and put in all these fascinating little elements, like we talked about last month in the the four-wheel drive system and how that evolved and all those things.
Right.
And so, yeah, we came up with that. And we it basically works around five elements. If you go into the online version, you'll see it's Birth of a Legend, Design and Engineering, Manufacturing, Capability and Lifestyle. And they're the elements that you tell the story around. And so, yeah, obviously Birth of a Legend's based around, you know, how on earth did they, you know, get to the point where they're suddenly changing direction from luxury cars to you know, a work vehicle. And it's all based around, you know, the reality of the Solihull factory. They had to use the Solihull factory because the Coventry factory was bombed flat. So, you know, that double the size, you can produce double the cars. And, you know, they set that out fairly, you know, close towards the end of the Second World War. But obviously they, you know, once the Land Rover was well into production by 1950, they'd achieved that goal. They'd got 16,000 Land Rovers and 4,000 Rover cars out. So, man, you know, what's the next goal? And telling all those little bits that people didn't really know.
Mm-hmm.
That was what it was all about.
Right. I visited apparently a year too early. I didn't get that full experience, but it's good that it's online so you can check it out.
Yeah, yeah. We wanted to do that because it was a little bit difficult towards you know, getting that tour going, because it took a long time to string it all together, and also to get all the parts. The parts were quite difficult to get, because originally we wanted to obviously try and do 1948. We realised, you know, that there's no way we were going to get, you know, some of the, you know, if we were going to get the correct engines, the engine block on a 1948 model is different to that of a 1949 and a 1950. So where do you get them from? Where do you, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So we decided to set the liners around about October 1949, which fitted in with the, you know, the fleet vehicles that Land Rover has as demonstrators of that era.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, that was it. Took we probably started looking at it probably about 18 months before the tour really sort of started, in trying to, you know, make sure that the parts are all available and all that kind of thing. So there's no point in, you know, trying to get that idea and get it all signed off and everything if you suddenly, oh, you know, we can't get four chassis, or we can't get this, or we can't get that. So it took a lot of planning.
Right.
Did that play any part in setting up the Land Rover Heritage Division? Or can you not comment on that?
I think one thing I always wanted to do, I suppose from being an enthusiast, and being an enthusiast who's worked a lot with modern media, one thing when I'd done in the 1990s with a chap called Lloyd Allison back in Australia, who started fourwheeldriveonline.com, is I'd, you know, done a lot of writing and seen the, you know, sort of the, I suppose the power that you can have of, you know, accessing people, or people accessing information really quickly. And so what I wanted to do was with the celebration line was to show an opportunity that they have with the various Land Rover Experience Centres, which run their own social media outlet. So the rest of, obviously, Land Rover is all run by, you know, the marketing department. They look after social media, and they obviously have all their, you know, their calendar of what they're going to talk about and how that's all going to fit. Whereas Land Rover Experience, obviously, it's based around, you know, what the centres are doing and what guests can come and see. And, yeah, you can talk a little bit about the marketing stuff, or the yacht racing, or the new, you know, Discovery Sport or whatever that's up at the time. But of course you're trying to, you know, say people, oh, you can come to Land Rover Experience and you can go off-roading in a Range Rover, or you can go on the jungle track, or you can go on a factory tour. So I had a bit of an idea, is, you know, being Solihull, why don't we do a launch to this event, but do it as a sort of a slow burn event, a little bit like sort of the opposite of what they did with it when they launched Evoque. They did Evoque because they launched it as the LRX, as a sort of very, you know, production ready prototype, and then slowly teased people for ages and ages and ages once they knew that it was going to work. And so with the celebration line, I sort of did the opposite of that. I went onto social media and we slowly teased people for about 12 months or so with photographs of the factory back in the day. of, you know, the production line here and the jungle track here and this era and that era, and build up a huge audience behind that. And of course, the end aim was to, you know, show one photo and then say, and you can come and do this as an experience. You can come back to the factory and you can see a replica 80-inch Land Rover production line. And I was fairly convinced that, you know, once you'd done that, as A, it'd probably sell out fairly quickly, and B, of course, it would give them a really good insight into what to do with Defenders, potentially do with Defenders' heritage and legacy. Because obviously there's a lot of talk of, you know, we could do this and do that, and obviously they have to supply parts for the modern version. You know, obviously if you supply parts for the modern version, it gives you an opportunity to supply parts for, you know, older versions as well. And so we did that launch, and it went absolutely crazy. It went completely nuts. It did 60,000 people on day one looking at the photographs, which I just took on my phone and put online. And, the phones went absolutely crazy. The emails went crazy. It was the tour was, you know, we hoped to get about 20 people in the morning and 20 people in the afternoon. We're ending up usually around about 50 people in the morning and 50 people in the afternoon. And that was the maximum you could actually do. You couldn't physically take any more people in there. It was impossible. So it was completely sold out. And of course, once that story, you know, got around the company, of course, the board wanted to come and have a look at it. So I wasn't going to let that opportunity escape.
Yeah.
So you know, I took them all around and gave them the celebration tour, Mike Bishop style, full guns blazing. they enjoyed it. And it was good because, obviously, at that level, people who, you know, run companies like that, there's a lot of pressure and they've got to make a lot of difficult decisions. You know, they've got to make the business decision. They can't just go and make decisions with their heart because that, you know, might not be the right decision. You've got to make a decision that makes money and preserves jobs and all those kind of things. And yeah, they really, you know, enjoyed it. And I think it gave people sort of a boost within the company. Actually, you know, we can do something with this history. It's not just, you know, about, you know, selling, you know, t-shirts and coffee cups. You know, this, the people are genuinely interested in this at, you know, from a corporate structure.
Do you expect the celebration line tour to continue in the medium term, I suppose? It's not currently set to end at the end of the year or in a couple of years.
Well, the celebration tour stopped with Defender. It did.
Oh, so it's over.
So yeah, the celebration tour, when Defender stopped, the tour stopped.
Okay. And then, there's been discussion, at least we've heard discussion about a special tour being created or already set up for that of how things were built back in the early days. Is that coming or going to come back, or what don't I understand?
Obviously, we're going to start doing restorations at Solihull, and that's what's happening. So there's 10 or so people have been kept back from Defender production to start restorations. And there's a little bit about it in LRO, the most recent LRO magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to get some vehicles from around the world and obviously restore them to customer requests. You know, so yeah, someone can, you know, depending on what they buy and what they get, or what people, you know, there's obviously going to be probably people who turn up and say, yeah, I've had this old Land Rover for however many years. Can you please restore it? I'm interested in having it restored at Solihull. So that's what's going to happen next.
Okay.
So exciting times. Watch this space and we'll see what happens.
Will there be tours of that?
It'd be nice, wouldn't it? It'd be nice, but it's obviously, you know, talking about the numbers and how you do it, I'm not quite sure yet how to achieve. I don't think it'll be achievable on the scale that we did with the celebration line. But we'll see. Never say never. Okay. Never say never.
Fair enough. So there's hope for me yet.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, everyone always asks that question when you're going around the celebration line, or where's all this stuff going to go? And, you know, depending on, you know, the everyone's sense of humour, you could sort of, you know, start to say, oh, I'll, you know, I think I'll buy it for, you know, a fiver off the company or something like that. But I said, obviously, it's been so successful in reality, they're not going to throw it in the bin or sell it to someone for 10 quid or anything like that. They're going to, you know, they can see the value in it. They're going to keep it, and it will evolve into another experience in some way, shape or form at some point in the future. But just at the moment, we're not quite sure or how we're going to do that. Obviously, we've got to, you know, there's been a little bit of a revolution at Sully Hall with Defender stopping. You know, obviously there's, you know, the main business plans, which everybody's working on for, you know, what's going to happen next at Sully Hall, which once again, they, you know, nobody will talk about it because that's all just in evolution.
Which I would be remiss in if we didn't actually ask, since you're on the show. I think I know what the answer is going to be, but we got to put it on the record. What's coming next for the Defender? Where, you know, what's two going to be look like? What's it going to be look like? I know the answer, but I have to ask.
Yeah. You have to ask the question.
I have to,
even though we've been told we can't.
Obviously, there's going to be a Defender of the future, and that vehicle won't be formally announced for a number of years. And so you'll just have to wait until that point. But when we, on the last day, we went down to London to the BBC with that last car, you know, and Nick Rogers, who's the engineering director, and he said to everybody on the one show, the BBC one show, you won't be disappointed. Basically, you know, the main, you know, DNA which has come across through the series vehicles and the Defender is, you know, alive and well, and will move forward into that next vehicle. And, you know, that's the answer at the moment. We can't tell you anymore, unfortunately.
I understand.
I think I read somewhere that last Defender was actually number 2,033,000 and something or other. Is that what I heard?
Yeah, something like that. If I looked in my emails on the phone, I'd find it. I can't remember exactly. It was 2 million or something. Yeah,
it was
about
significantly
that.
Over 2 million, as I recall.
Oh, yeah. It was well over 2 million. Yeah. I mean, the Defender line was absolutely flat out until it stopped.
Is that vehicle also going to Gaydon with Huey?
No, that's going to be retained by Land Rover Heritage.
Okay. Oh, nice. Okay. Yeah, I hadn't really heard what was happening with that vehicle. Okay. Because I thought maybe you'd see them paired up at Gaydon, you know, the first
makes,
and the last,
makes great
if you will.
Bookends.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Oh, there'll be opportunities to have the two of them together, no doubt. And obviously, you know, at Gaydon, you know, museum is right beside Gaydon Engineering. The two are Land Rover, Jaguar Land Rover, and the British Motor Museum are very closely.
Right.
Intertwined, so there will be that opportunity, but obviously now we've got this Land Rover Heritage movement. Yeah, they need a few toys as well, don't they?
Well, it's not going far, at least.
No, it won't be going terribly far at all. Yeah, so watch this space. I'm sure she'll come out for a few photos soon.
Cool. One question, and I'm trying to formulate it in my head for a bit here, but I'm not sure if I'll get it right out of the gate, but. Yeah, I assume that JLR is aware of the interest here in the United States for Defender. How much does that take into consideration for ideas and thoughts? And does that help with the restoration? Is that why there was a restoration kind of set up for Land Rover? Are we going to see more parts over here? Is it going to be easier for us to get them? I apologize for not having a well-formed answer. I'm just trying to say, you know, we're over here and there's an interest, and you know, the vehicles do not lose their value here. The Defenders keep their, in fact, increase in value the older they get. I assume that's well known.
Yeah, that is well known. And so, I mean, if you look at, I suppose, the way Defender, you know, evolved to where it was from, you know, sort of the late Series 2A and the Series 3. In that era, the late 2A and Series 3, you ended up with this vehicle, because that's originally when it was going to be replaced with a vehicle. I've got a drawing of it, a 111-inch wheelbase vehicle. It actually, styling-wise, looked a little bit like a 60s Ford Bronco. That was the original idea to replace it. Because once you eventually, when they didn't replace it, they inevitably ended up with, okay, when does it stop? Because you broke down the original, you know, development life cycle of a vehicle, because all vehicles, they have a life cycle and a business life cycle. They make so many units, they make so much money, they do this, and the money you make, you eventually invest and make something new to keep up with the competition. Defender went outside that little mold, and obviously in the British Leyland days, you know, it kept everything sort of ticking along, because it was profitable, and, you know, it ended up in the days of the 1980s where, you know, they improved the chassis dramatically with the coil springs, but obviously they were sort of they felt slightly, you know, like they weren't in the right place to keep up with the competition. And, you know, I suppose, you know, if you look at it from two points of view, the first point of view is, yes, they had the older body style, which, you know, which we all love, and it's perfectly functional, and that, but it's, you know, it wasn't the body that was designed in the 1950s. And the other element, of course, was that, you know, the line rate is incredibly slow compared to a modern vehicle. So you can only produce so many of them. So they were the two things that were ultimately, you know, stuck with, which have, you know, obviously positives and negatives. The positive around the body is, of course, you get that iconic look, and it's incredibly functional, and you can modify it, and you can do this and that to it.
Can we go back to something you said? I want to go back. You said something about when they went from Series 3 to the Stage 1, there was consideration of changing the body style. Is that correct? Because you talked about it looking like a Bronco. Is that
It was in the 1960s. It was in the late 1960s. It was a vehicle called the 111, or 111 inch, and it wasn't the vehicle you're thinking of. Is a vehicle called SD5, which looked like a bit like a Range Rover pickup, but the 111, it looked like a Bronco pickup. That's what effectively the styling was of the time, but it didn't get off the paper. British Leyland came in and they said, no, we're not going to put investment money into that. We're just going to keep it as it is, because it makes money, and, you know, we want to put the investment money into other products, which they thought at the time was the right idea.
Well, if it ain't broke,
but unfortunately for them, it was the wrong idea. And this is where on a Defender tour, often things would get really, really interesting, depending on what people thought of, you know, Defender, you know, coming to an end. Yeah. And we talk about that vehicle in that time of, you know, all of the various stages that they considered, you know, in the 60s, in the 70s. Later on when they were wanting to replace it. If they had replaced it, you probably would have ended up with something a lot more mainstream.
Right.
And a lot of volume would be very different. Is that what you'd want?
Right, because they would have done more.
Some people would say, yes, that's what I want. I want something like that. And the majority of people would say, no, we want, you know, the vehicle as it is, you know, as it was. And I say it's an interesting point, isn't it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. For that to exist, you had to go through, once again, through all that pain for, you know, the vehicle to go through the British Leyland stage, survive that, you know, come into the 1980s, stay as a mainstream military vehicle for the British Army, which is the bread and butter, and then get to this point where, you know, the British Army weren't buying vehicles anymore, so they could push it up market.
Right. And actually, the U.S. Army Rangers used Defenders for a short period of time, too.
They did, yes, mm-hmm. yes.
Mm-hmm. For not long.
Not many people know that fact outside the U.S. In this day and age.
Yeah.
But, they were.
Yeah, there's actually a friend who was trained to be a Ranger, and he's like, oh, we got to drive Defenders. It was pretty, yeah. So you are now you're the Celebration Project lead, and I guess that's come to a close, and you're still working as the instructor. What's coming up next for you? You're working on a bulk improvement, I believe. Anything else going on that you can share with us and our audience?
Yeah, I'm going to rewrite the book from, you know, what we've found. on the, you know, especially on the mock-up vehicle, and, you know, more of what we've, you know, Arthur's helped us realize what has been achieved. And myself, yeah, I'm just looking forward to the, you know, the next project. I've had a few little projects lately. I can't unfortunately tell you terribly much about them at this point. Yeah, one of my friends on Facebook says you turn up everywhere, and you know, when you see the next element come to life, yeah, I'm sure, hopefully I've had a piece of it, or had my finger apart, or given a bit of advice. The one project I did really enjoy last year, which was a sideline project to the Celebration Tour, I don't know if you saw it in the States terribly much, it's called the Defender Taxi video.
Yes.
Yeah, that was myself and a couple of colleagues. We sat down one morning with a creative team and came up with the stories behind that, which was really fun. It was really, really good.
Yeah, that was cool. Oh, we thought that was Land Rover Marketing. I didn't realize that was you.
No, it was me and Ange and Carmel.
Cool. That was very cool.
And it was fun. It was really fun. So they're basically what they do with that is someone obviously comes up with the idea, and the idea was, you know, Roger's going to be the taxi driver to get, you know, the guest to Bonhams to potentially buy the 2 millionth
yep.
Defender.
Pretty cool.
And what can happen on that journey, you know, and that was basically the brief, what was happened. So, Carmel rang me up and said, oh, you'll be really good at this. And I said, yeah, I will. So I sat down for a day and just wrote, you know, sort of thought of London, because London's such a beautiful, interesting city to go to.
Mm-hmm.
If you were walking around the city, what would you see happening around there where Land Rovers could be involved? And I thought of all kinds of crazy ideas. You know, you could walk past, you know, a church, and there could be people married, you know, in, you know, having Land Rover as a wedding car. There's, you know, the sky's the limit.
Oh, yeah.
So we wrote down all these ideas, and then we got the storyboard of what was going to be in the video, and then just applied the ideas that worked with the storyboard. And obviously the ice cream van was a key one. Getting the six-wheel drive in, the old Reynolds Broughton 6x6 was a key one, because that vehicle's based at Eastner, at LRA Eastner. It is, and it also has a distinctive registration number, which I wanted one of the newer clubs to sort of come up and chat with on their Facebook page, which they did. And then, you know, other, you know, cool little things, like the one I really liked was the TD5 graffiti on the wall. That was quite a good idea. It was, because, you know, we wanted to sort of go back in time, and, you know, yeah, a lot of people over here, if they've got a Land Rover, which they, I suppose bling up a little bit, it's usually a TD5.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that was kind of cool. And then also we always wanted to use the best 4x4 by far slogan again. You know, so we, you know, had that with the kid with the balloons. So yeah, it was brilliant fun. And it was only a morning's work. It was only, you know, two and a half hours of us just brainstorming a couple of cups of coffee.
Yeah.
Wow. What can you tell us about the LRE Trek?
The LRE Trek, the latest one.
Yeah.
Okay, so the LRE Trek, it's I suppose it's what it is. It's for LRE's growing, very, very quickly, and they wanted to have an event so that people could sort of hone their skills in a sort of along the lines of the old famous events, you know, Camel Trophy, G4, some of the expeditions and that kind of thing, you know, where, you know, in today's world, there really isn't the opportunity to do that quite so much unless you're lucky enough to have done a full, you know, press event or a couple of them. So, it came about, and, the original Land Rover LRE Trek event, I think it was, you know, the idea came from the States, from Bob Burns, I think. And they did, you know, sort of, I suppose, team challenges and stuff. And, they just run the second event, and the Australian LRE team won it. And it was good. It was really good.
What was your involvement with it?
Nothing, absolutely nothing.
You weren't in that?
No.
Okay.
No, I haven't had anything to do with it. too much, you know, because I suppose I'm so history based with what I've been doing over the past 12 to 18 months that you can't do every event. There's so many of them. The event that I've liked, that I've been on, that I enjoyed the most, was the Range Rover launch in Morocco in 2012. That was unbelievable as an event. I mean, the millionth discovery event. Yeah, that was pretty good too.
I saw that.
The one I've done recently, most recently, was the Discovery Sports launch event in Iceland. I built a track defender. That was once again really, really good. But that Range Rover event was something else. It was.
Yeah, did you meet Jeff Aronson at the Discovery Sport in Iceland? Because he attended that. He's the editor of Rovers magazine here in the U.S. Doesn't ring a bell.
Doesn't ring a bell, but that's fine. You ask him if he spoke to the guy who looked after the tracked defender.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. Very well. He's a cool guy. He's a good guy. He's been on the show a couple times, and as I said, he's editor of the Rovers North, has a magazine called Rovers Magazine. Good guy.
Could have done. I built up this defender with Matt Trax on it for that event.
I think he talked about
and did
that.
About. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sorry,
I said I remember him talking about that. And it was the weather turned pretty foul, I think, and had to be used a couple times to pull some trucks out, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, we used it all the time. It was unbelievable. I did about 3,000 kilometers in that vehicle. I think I'm the person who's done. Probably somebody can prove me wrong from your show, because probably obviously they're based in the States, but I think 3,000 kilometers in 4 weeks is quite a lot on Matt Trax.
Yes.
I'm not entirely sure, but there's nothing to benchmark it against, you know, to say, you know, that, but it was an epic vehicle to use.
Very cool. That's very cool. Mm. Well, Mike, I want to thank you for being on the show, and I hope you got to cover everything you wanted to discuss. Is there anything else before we let you go?
No, thank you very much for having me.
It was wonderful. I told you we were excited, and you exceeded my expectations.
Oh, thank you.
I mean that too. That wasn't me being sarcastic. To remind everybody where they can track you down on Facebook, your AC. No, I got it wrong already. 260 AC, correct?
Yes, and on Twitter as well. 260
AC. And I guess if a listener goes to Sully Hall for the experience, can they ask for you? Is that a possibility, or do you just get a random instructor?
No, you can request me, but I do get, obviously, if you heard, you know, the story about the taxi video, I get a lot of requests internally and externally from the company. So, sometimes I'm available. Unfortunately, sometimes I'm not. So it's lucky. It's lucky dip.
Understood.
Can you be reserved in advance?
I often am. So, which is flattering. It's very flattering. Yeah.
Indeed. We're flattered you joined us. You took the time out of your day to join us on the podcast. So thanks very much. Really appreciate it.
No, pleasure. Thank you.
All right. That's our show for this month. This is March 2016. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I thank you for listening. Please visit our website for past shows and, of course, all the show notes. Don't forget to connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. You know, we are interested in your feedback on news, topics that we covered this month, and even on the audio quality, which we continue to make sure is good, or at least I think it's good. We have Land Rover listeners from around the world. Most recently, in checking our Facebook page, we added folks in Chile, Israel, Costa Rica, Taiwan, and, of course, the United Kingdom.
And not to mention our good friends from South Africa by way of Mexico.
That's right, they're in Mexico.
So that's two countries, isn't it?
Two for the price of one.
Yes, there you go.
We'd love to hear from you. So, you know, as you can see there, we're on Facebook, we're on Twitter. You can even send us an email if you like. Send us a picture of your Land Rover that you're driving, or maybe even one that you're lusting after. Don't forget also to visit the 4x4 Radio Network to listen to all the other shows that are part of the network. You can listen right on the website to our show and the other shows. Until the next Intersteer podcast, I ask you to share our show with one fellow Land Rover owner. Thanks for listening, and please wave as you pass by.
Yeah, our podcast was conceived as a 45-minute show.